Welcome to the Voice of Truth on 103.3 WAJR-FM, the radio broadcast ministry of Christian Apostolic Church in Clarksburg, West Virginia. And now, your host, author, teacher, and pastor, Doug Joseph.
Welcome to the Voice of Truth. This is Pastor Doug Joseph, and my special guest today is Reverend John F. Harrison.
Other than watching paint dry, there's not a lot exciting, less exciting than a book about financial management. But this one, it was actually this nonfiction book that convinced me to do the novel. Because in Making Mammon Serve You, there are two fictional chapters. One is the first chapter, which creates three hypothetical churches and highlights and contrasts how they deal with money in those churches. And the other one is a chapter that features a debate between two preachers on a contentious financial subject in the church world. And it is those two chapters that really grab people. People like the information in all the other chapters. But I'll tell you, I had one man tell me that he was reading the debate chapter. He got so upset he threw the book. and people really relate to those chapters. So it's by no means a dry and academic book, even though it does cover a lot of hard information. And I think it will help people really feel like they've got a degree of control and understanding that's usually missing in most people's personal financial lives.
Now, regarding finances, one of the things that has been really mind-blowing for me that you opened my eyes to was how that there are certain things in the world of money that are counterintuitive. The reality is the exact opposite of what you would have thought the reality is. And people are really bad at counterintuitive. You know, the thing that we absolutely think that has to be the way it is. And this is one of the surprises that researchers get when researchers delve into challenge, de-challenge, re-challenge. And you get these double-blind, randomized studies, and the raw fact that is churned out at the end is oftentimes mind-boggling to them because it's exactly the opposite of what they thought it was going to be going into it. And there are some aspects of the world of finances that are counterintuitive. And I have one that I wanted to mention, but I'm sure you have a laundry list of them. But I, you know, as many Christian finance counselors advise, you know, debt is bad. Avoiding debt is wise, with the only possible exception being that a mortgage on a home, you have the potential for its appreciation and value to outpace the interest rate that you're paying, or at least compete with it fairly decently. And, you know, Dave Ramsey and others advise that, you know, a home mortgage is perhaps maybe the only debt obligation that makes sense. But obviously the goal would be to avoid all unsecured debt, avoid all auto loan debt. For heaven's sake, avoid debt on something that loses value over time. And currently, my wife and I, that's where we are. We've been totally debt-free for several years now, except for our home loan. And I remember, and you know, sometimes it's kind of like two steps forward, one step back. We got totally debt-free except for our home loan. And instead of saving up for our next car loan, and instead of driving the thing until it fell apart, you know, and blew up, as Dave Ramsey says, we just basically fell in. I got lured into this sales gimmick of the no-interest loan. And I learned later with chagrin that all they do is they take all the interest of the loan and front load it onto the purchase price of the vehicle. You pay all the interest. You pay all the interest in getting a bad deal the day you negotiate. So we got this vehicle. It was a Grand Caravan, got it on a no interest loan. And so we were back into having some debt. And so we paid that down as quick as we could. We got it paid off. And I thought right off the bat, well, the thing we need to do now is to save up for another car. And looking at some numbers, which I just did recently, I'm realizing we probably should have started socking that extra money each month as applying to the principal on our home loan instead of saving it for a car loan, or at least some of it. We've been disciplined with regard to our mortgage in that from the very start of our mortgage, we always paid $50 extra every month against the principal. And then when interest rates dipped to historical lows and it made sense to refinance, we refinanced. So the refinance, the $50 each month had shaved time off the end of the loan. The refinance then shaved some time off the end of the loan. And then continuing with the $50 each month was continuing to shave time off the end of the loan. And so then we did, we feel like at this point we've successfully saved up enough money that if one of our vehicles does finally blow up, we'll be able to pay cash for another vehicle and not have to be back into a car loan. But I started asking myself the question of, should we take this car loan money that we've saved up and just sock it against the principal of the loan and then start fresh on trying to save up for a car loan? And I'd worked on it and, you know, into the night. And, you know, some people that's a really bad mistake, and other people that's when their brain comes alive the most. And I met a man down in Texas who told me his best moment was when he opened his eyes in the morning. That's not my best moment.
I'm that guy
who leans toward nocturnal, and my brightest moments of creativity come, you know, in the wee hours. But so I was crunching the numbers, looking at the impact. We've got our emergency fund locked in a CD, earning a great interest rate. And the interest rates are in the toilet now, so we were glad we locked it in when we did. And then we've got this just in a regular online savings account. We've got this money set aside from side jobs and book royalties and from this where we've been paying a car payment to ourselves. So we've got about $14,000 or $15,000 in there. And so I was running the numbers on what it would look like if I just socked a chunk of $14,000 against the principal. How much does that shorten our end of the loan, and how much money in interest does it save us? And then I thought, what if we hold on to that money? Because I remember one of the things you taught me was about when the money is in your hand, you have lots of options. But the minute you pick one of those options and actually spend the money, you're choosing that option at the expense of all the others. And I thought, what if we hold on to that money to hold on to our options? And what if this couple of $100 a month that we've been paying ourselves, basically making a car payment to ourselves for this last while, what if we started socking that $200 a month plus the $50 that we've been doing? So we would increase our principal, our extra principal payment each month from $50 to $250. And I was very surprised. It saved just doing that, just keeping the saved money in hand and just increasing the monthly extra from $50 to $250, it saved almost as much interest money as the big lump sum would, and it actually was more effective on shortening the final payoff of the loan. And that, to me, was counterintuitive. I didn't expect that. And so my precious wife, often when I have these brilliant moments, she's in bed sleeping, which what I probably should be doing. But I wanted to wake her up, but I didn't. I sent her an email that she would get in the morning, and we had already talked about it some in the days leading up to it, and so I knew that she would be comfortable with it. And I'm not one of these kind of chauvinists that just thinks, you know, I'm going to do what I'm going to do. I don't care what my wife says. And by the way, the responsibility that men bear in a marriage has nothing to do with ignoring your wife's wisdom. And any man who feels that way needs to go back to the book. But I knew she would be in favor of it. So that night, I canceled where we were paying ourselves a loan payment into our savings account. I canceled that, and I upped the extra payments to the bank. And then our only question was, do we do some lump sum also in addition to that? And so I ran the numbers on that, and I came to a conclusion when I showed her the analysis that I came up with. It was surprising to me. Either one of these two options were very powerful, but after having exercised either one of them, it made the other option not nearly so powerful as it was on its own. And that was very counterintuitive to me. A massive lump sum by itself, very powerful. The extra payments against principal, very powerful. But combining them is not double the powerful. One of them, and it's because of the way the interest payments taper off at the end of the loan, the interest, as the interest savings are dwindling down to nothing, it diminishes the effectiveness. And we both looked at it, and just for comparison's sake, if we made a big lump sum payment of $14,000, and then just kept paying the $50 extra, it accomplished this great result. And then if we were to agree to suffer, instead of $50 extra for the rest of the loan, doubling it to $100 extra, it would work out to 10 years of that doubled extra amount. And it would only save us $1,500 in interest. And would only shave a very meager amount of months off the end of the loan. And we thought that that's not worth it. And so in going back and forth, we finally decided it was to our advantage to hold on to the savings that we have in case one of our cars does blow up, and just change where this $200 a month has been going. And I've got this piece of paper here in front of me that basically shows that with no lump sum extra payment and just increasing our extra toward principal up from $50 to $250, it will shave 12 years off the loan and save us $21,500 of interest.
That's not a bad thing.
And so we have made that move. Yes. Hallelujah.
It's interesting you bring the particulars up, because one of the things I say whenever talking to people about financial things and we start dealing with real-world numbers and real-world life situations is the answer to every financial question is, it depends.
It depends.
And there's so many variables. And if we change any one or two of those variables, then your results are going to be very, very different.
Yeah.
And so people like to ask me questions like, should I do this or should I do that? It depends.
It depends.
Let's run the numbers.
Because the numbers surprise you sometimes.
Yeah, and people don't like that. They want to just tell me, there's got to be a rule that this way is always the right way.
Yeah.
And I always tell people, no, in fact, beware of people who always tell you it's always this way or always that way. Yeah. The truth is, it depends. Life is more complicated than we'd like it to be.
You know, what started me into this was I had logged into our bank, and there's our checking account, and there's our mortgage account. I clicked into the mortgage account, and our bank, as a good bank should, offered some options. Here's a little tool to see how extra principal applied each month would affect your loan. Here's a little tool to see how a lump sum would affect your loan. And not realizing that the truth of combining these two together is counterintuitive, you can foolishly, naturally assume that if I slide the slider on the extra each month, if I slide that slider over and it tells me it's going to knock 5 years and 6 months off and it's going to save, you know, $10,000 or $12,000 in interest or whatever, and I take that in my, put that in my little thinker, and then I go over to this other tool and I see what a lump sum would do, there's this foolish assumption, which isn't reality, that I can just simply add those two numbers of years saved together and add those two amounts of interest saved together. And that's not true. It's not true at all. And so I found that to get at the real numbers, what I had to do was go back to the start of the refinance. I had to bring a loan amortization up in Excel, run the numbers from the origin of the refinance, and I had to actually tweak the amortization chart, because it had one field, a named field for extra payments each month. I had to add a second alternate extra payments each month. And then at a set point down in the amortization chart, I had to manually change from there on in that field which one of those two named fields it referenced. Yeah. And then I had to then on the very first one of those, I had to manually key in any lump sum I was getting at. And that was the only way I could get realistic numbers. And as soon as I started getting realistic numbers, I was like, this is another one of those things that's counterintuitive. I'm so glad I took the time to do this. So what are some other things in finance that can be counterintuitive that people can run into?
There really are a number of things. And while you're on the subject of debt, I'll mention an issue with that as first on my list. The idea of, I agree with all the counselors who say, avoid consumer debt if you can possibly avoid it. Avoid going into debt for things that depreciate. You know, that car is worth less the day you drive it home than the day you when you sign the papers. I agree with all of that, but you know, we meet people where they are,
right?
And so often they come already up to their ears in consumer debt.
Yeah.
And so much of the thinking is, all right, stop everything. Don't save money. Put every spare dollar you can into eliminating that debt. And the counterintuitive truth is people would be better off usually putting some money toward accelerating their debt reduction and putting some money toward savings. And the reason for that, one is psychological and one's mathematical.
Yeah.
The psychological reason is that if you have no savings and all you've been doing is sucking money into the debt, sooner or later something happens. Your furnace goes out, the car needs a transmission, and because you have no savings, the only way you can rectify the situation is to go back deeper into debt.
More debt.
And psychologically, that's really damaging, because you're like, we were doing so well, and then we went the other way.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the issues. The more important one is the actual numerical, mathematical truth, is that whatever debt you're paying is compound interest on a decreasing balance. And the money you save and invest is compound interest, excuse me, hitting the microphone here, is compound interest on an increasing balance. And so they're not equivalent.
They're not.
And people think, I've seen things in print, for instance, that, well, if you've got credit cards at 13%, stop putting money in your 401k and pay off the cards, because you're not getting 13% in your 401k. Even if you're not, the money in your 401k is that compounding on an increasing balance, and you'll never get the time back or the opportunity to put that year's money in.
Yeah.
So it's a huge mistake to not save and invest in order to put everything into eliminating the compound interest on the decreasing balance at the expense of the compound interest on an increasing balance. That's a counterintuitive thing, but once people see the numbers, their eyes get big and wow, I've cost myself a lot of money by doing this.
Yeah.
So that's one of those things. The definition of safety is one of those counterintuitive things. If I had a few hours to go into it, I talk about even the definition of money is counterintuitive. But the definition, most people's definition of safety is, if I give a bank 100 pictures of Ben Franklin, I want to know that when I go back in 2 months, there's 100 pictures of Ben Franklin waiting for me to withdraw. That's safety. My principal is guaranteed. And that safety, if what you are trying to preserve is currency, but really what people are trying to preserve is money.
Yeah.
And money and currency are not the same thing.
They are not the same.
Money is purchasing power.
Yeah.
And currency loses purchasing power because of inflation and taxes. So your money in the bank that is paying you at this point, you know, 0.2% interest will buy you less in 12 months than it buys you today.
Yeah.
And people feel like it's safe there because I got my same number of pictures of Ben Franklin back. But what they're really doing is going broke safely, because every year their money buys them less.
Yeah.
So what safety is anything that preserves your purchasing power. And in that sense, the money that's in your 401k is safer than the money that you have in the bank.
Yes.
Because although the short-term units of currency fluctuate, the actual purchasing power tends to grow over time, and that doesn't happen with cash or cash equivalents or money in the bank. That's very counterintuitive. People approach retirement, and they tell me, just put the money someplace where it will be safe. And I always have to have the conversation, define safe. I look at my own father. He retired when he was 62, and he had a company pension. If listeners are under the age of 40, they're like, what's that?
Yeah.
But he had a company pension, he had Social Security, and it was enough money that he and my mother were living pretty well. But he lived to be 87. And in his later years, that fixed income didn't go nearly far enough.
Yeah.
And he was beginning to struggle to pay for things. And, you know, it was safe in terms of his units of currency never fluctuated. But it wasn't safe because his purchasing power was declining, and that meant that his standard of living was declining, and that's not most people's idea of safe. So there's many, many counterintuitive things like that that if people are willing to hear, they're not hard to understand. They're just a different way of looking at things that will help people lead happier financial lives.
And I know anybody in our church knows this, but for our listening audience and anyone watching an archival copy of this, I am absolutely convinced that John F. Harrison is a genius. And in particular, his genius shines in the area of finances. And a big part of that is being able to take the complex, abstract, weird reality of the situation and break it down in an understandable way. That's part of the reason why that Brother Harrison, who in addition to being a certified financial planner, is also an ordained minister of the gospel. But it's a reason why he is sought after and is a very common guest on the Blassingame radio broadcast. Remind me of the name of the broadcast again.
Jim Blassingame, he calls his show The Small Business Advocate.
Yes.
It's nationally syndicated, both on terrestrial radio and also internet radio. And he's made me part of what he calls his brain trust, and which is a group of recurring guests. And we were I interviewed with him about 3 weeks ago, and we were amazed to discover that it's been about 8 years that I've been on the show.
Wow!
And really, it's a great show. And I say that not because I'm sometimes on it, but he's a real, for anyone who makes money from self-employment or from owning their own corporation or anything like that. He's just a real font of great information, and it's a funny show.
For any of our viewers that are pastors of a church, I strongly recommend that you get with John F. Harrison regarding your personal retirement and regarding your church finances. He has many astounding, powerful, clever ways of getting done what you need done that can really help you in your finances. He's been a tremendous blessing to our church and to us personally. And the thought occurs to me that when we had you help us before, like 7 years ago, we had some priorities then. And over time, some things have turned out better than expected. Other things didn't turn out at all. And so over time, our priorities have shifted. And some of how you helped us was based on what we were telling you at that time was a priority that we wanted to honor. And because some of those priorities have faded away, we probably need to rethink some of what we are doing as a result. And it strikes me that this is something, this touches on what is perhaps the greatest weakness among married couples and the greatest weakness in families in America with regard to their finances, is just a raw failure of planning, just failure to actually analyze where we're going, where we're trying to get to, how do we plan on getting there, what's the nitty-gritty detail of making that happen, are we doing great, are we doing poorly, what changes, what kind of strategy do we have? And sadly, many people are just like, well, you know, I work at so-and-so, and they have a such-and-such 401 whatever. What else can I do besides that? And there's a lot more that can be done. Talk about a little bit about what can be done to help folks there.
I really like, and I'll start by saying, I really like the point you made about failure to plan, because there's a famous Yogi Berra-ism that says, if you don't know where you're going, you'll probably end up somewhere else. And it's a lot of truth to that. And in driving here today, I did something that I hadn't done the last time I was here. I used a GPS. I let the Google Maps lady tell me turn by turn how to get here. And it's a really neat thing, because if you miss a street or overshoot something, you hear that little noise, and she recalibrates and says, okay, in that case, take a right on this street, and it gets me back on track. And that's kind of what financial planning should be. Things do change as time goes, and needs change, priorities change, circumstances change, and you need the flexibility to note what has changed and what, if anything, we now need to do differently. And just hoping that it all works out usually doesn't work out. You have to plan right along. And I got so impassioned about saying that, I forgot what the first half of your question was.
some examples of what people can do to, beyond just, I work at so-and-so and I have a 401k, what's a basic game plan that they really ought to tackle to get beyond that meager starting place?
Well, they definitely need a few things that are their own and not provided by their employer.
Yeah.
And I would start with just basic savings. People need emergency funds, depending on their situation, anywhere from 3 months to 12 months worth of their living expenses in savings in an emergency fund. People can invest outside of their 401ks or other employer plans and should.
Yeah.
You can do things in terms of playing the tax code outside of your 401k that you can't do within it. And what I mean by that is in your 401k, you're getting the tax deduction for the money that's being contributed, and it's growing tax deferred. You have a silent partner in that account. That's Uncle Sam. And on the day you start making withdrawals, he'll tell you how much of your withdrawal he wants. And you won't really have much of a choice but give it to him.
Yeah.
So on your own, you can do things that are taxed differently. You can have a standard taxable brokerage account. You pay taxes on it as you go, but you can take advantage of capital gains rates, which are lower than ordinary income tax rates. You can also do things with Roth options where after-tax money goes in, but it grows free of tax, and provided some I's are dotted and some T's are crossed, the money comes out tax-free. So it's one of the few arrangements that lets you understand how much spending money you'll have when the time comes, because whatever comes out is spendable.
Yeah.
Whereas on the traditional retirement plans, what you are seeing come out is a gross distribution, and what will be spendable is whatever portion of that Uncle Sam allows you to keep. So doing things with different tax treatments, doing things that make different kinds of investments available. Your 401k will have anywhere from 5 to 15 or so different mutual funds in it. But there are about 9,000 mutual funds in the world to choose from today, not to mention individual stocks, individual bonds, things that aren't related to stocks and bonds at all. Being able to broadly diversify your holdings so that whatever goes on in the world, and you know, today when you turn on the news, you wonder about what's going on in the world and how it's going to impact you. There's a Bible verse in Ecclesiastes that I think really ties into this idea, and it says, "Give a portion to seven and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be on the earth."
Yeah.
And I look at that and say, that's a good asset allocation strategy.
Yeah.
If you have seven or eight asset classes, cash, stocks, bonds, other things, pretty much the demise of one of them won't sink you.
Yeah.
You know, maybe the stock market is far down, but gold prices are up. Or maybe, and so by spreading out, if far beyond what's provided it by your employer, you can make yourself both safer and much better off over the long term.
I think the old timey wisdom is don't put all of your eggs in one basket.
Amen.
And so I do want to mention, especially for heaven's sake, do buy his books, glean from the wisdom. This precious man has journeyed long. And you're a bit of a road warrior. He's got a great strategy on buying really, really well-made cars that you can get lots of long life out of. And he is willing to make road trips that would make others faint. And he has driven a long way to be with us. And I encourage you, avail yourself of this opportunity. Come and hear him speak. It will bless you. And it will strengthen and encourage you and help you. Hear him preach the word of God. Hear him teach on finances, and you will benefit from it. My longtime friend, I am so glad to have you with us in Clarksburg. Thank you so much for being here with us. We'll go ahead and wrap up our broadcast, but do you have any last words you want to give?
Just thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to helping any and all that I can, any way that I can while I'm here. And it's great to be back both for that aspect of things and just to see you again, because it's been a while.
Yes, sir.
So thank you for having me, and I'm looking forward to the days to come.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for listening. You can reach us online at cac.us.com. Catch the Voice of Truth broadcast each Sunday morning at 11:30 right here on Talk Radio 103.3 WAJR-FM.